Our next case this morning is the state of Minnesota versus, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Morris Dixon, case file number 821-0205. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. As I'm sure you are all aware, the oral argument is being recorded, but we do prohibit private recordings by either counsel or any observers who are watching us on Zoom. So just please be mindful of that. With that, counsel for the appellant, you may begin. Just please identify yourself in a loud, clear voice.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, my name is Jordan Rood, and I represent the appellant in this case, the state of Minnesota. In this case, the district court dismissed a charge of fifth-degree possession against respondent due to a lack of probable cause. This ruling was an error because the district court misapplied the probable cause standard and required proof beyond a reasonable doubt at the probable cause stage. The district court also created a bright-line rule for probable cause that directly conflicts with precedent from this court. When analyzed under the proper standard, the state has established sufficient evidence of probable cause in this case, and the district court's decision should be reversed. The district court ruled that the state must fully test marijuana before it can establish probable cause for possession of marijuana based on the recent change in the law that makes possession of marijuana illegal, but possession of industrial hemp legal. This ruling conflates proof beyond a reasonable doubt with probable cause, because the consequence of this ruling is to require the state to completely establish at the probable cause stage that this that the substance in question is beyond a reasonable doubt marijuana. Of course, proof beyond a reasonable doubt is not what is required at the probable cause stage. Per the language of State v. Harris, probable cause requires only a probability or substantial chance of criminal activity, not an actual showing of such activity. And the district court's holding, in essence, requires the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this substance is in fact marijuana by requiring complete laboratory testing of that substance rather than a field test in conjunction with other circumstances and evidence.
Can I ask you this? Was there any dispute at any time during the litigation of this matter that that there was probable cause for the arrest?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. My understanding is that this was based on a traffic stop, and that the only litigation was regarding the lack of evidence of the identity of the substance. I don't believe that there was any challenge to the stop itself.
Right. And apparently there is some reference in the briefing that somehow whatever probable cause you need to make an arrest is not the same probable cause that you need for a hearing under Florence. How do you respond to that argument? That somehow it's probable cause plus. And is there any support, or are you aware of any support for that type of analysis of whether there's probable cause to proceed to trial?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any authority or case law that about, as you call this sort of probable cause plus. I understand that there's some language referencing a directed verdict or a motion for acquittal considering whether probable cause has been met. But I think that the more useful language, perhaps the more understandable language, is that language from Harris, that what probable cause is not, is it's not an actual showing that crime has been committed, but rather a substantial or probable chance that criminal activity has been committed. And so I think that some sort of probable cause plus or something like that would essentially negate the difference between proof beyond a reasonable doubt and probable cause, which is of course an important distinction in the charging process and the trial process.
Well, Is there a standard for determining probable cause, the totality of the circumstances?
Yes, I think that, you know, the court obviously looks at the evidence that the state has presented at that point, whether through a complaint or testimony at a Rasmussen or other pretrial hearing. And, you know, the state, the court would consider all the evidence that was presented up to that point, and of course, reviews that evidence in the light most favorable to the state, because it is the probable cause stage and not something like proof beyond a reasonable doubt, where there is not that deference in terms of determining guilt.
So I was just going to ask you, Mr. Rood, so what, since we don't have a test, at least at this stage of the proceedings, or we don't have a test that according to the appellant is good enough, respondent, what facts should we be looking at? The admission, the slurring speech, I mean, what are the other facts that would justify probable cause?
First, I do believe that the field test that does exist in the record is still relevant, in that it does indicate the presence of THC. That's not an irrelevant fact. That's important to consider in conjunction with the other facts, which are first, as Your Honor noted, the slurred words that police noted during the stop, the smell of marijuana, which the police detected in the car, the appearance of the substance that was recovered, which looks like marijuana, again, the field test that I mentioned, and finally, the admission following a Miranda warning, the admission by the defendant that he had, in fact, possessed marijuana.
What if this field test had showed no evidence of THC, but you have all the other stuff? Would that be enough to survive a probable cause challenge?
I think that would be a much more difficult case to bring. Of course.
I would say it'd be a loser. That's what I would say. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, if I think it's marijuana, but, you know, I'm stupid and it's oregano, even though I paid $5,000 and even though there's, you know, whatever, 42.5 grams in the car, if it's not marijuana, I haven't committed a crime, right? I mean, and, you know, maybe I'm, no matter what I say, right?
That's right. And I think, you know, something like that situation where the field test was negative, that might lead to no charges at all, or perhaps at that point, the state would have to do some sort of more additional fact finding in order to bolster that case. But of course, you know, in a situation where the field test was negative, that would be much more difficult to establish probable cause. In this case, the positive field test, although not in itself, you know, a 100% certainty, it does support the other facts and circumstances and support a finding of probable cause.
Can I just want to clarify some of the differences between hemp and marijuana. I mean, the THC is that's the part of the product that gives you the high. Am I correct?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. Yes.
And so that if you're smoking hemp and rather than marijuana, you're not going to get the high that you would with marijuana. Am I correct on that as well?
Yes.
And someone who is a frequent user of marijuana is going to know the difference based upon the high they get, aren't they?
I would imagine so. Yes.
That they would be able, without a test, to be able to tell if it's hemp or marijuana, wouldn't they? Based on their reaction to the chemical, or.
Well, I think that would go to the other, you know, other circumstances that can support. So, you know, in this case, the defendant admitted, yes, I did possess marijuana. If this was a person who had smoked marijuana frequently, who was familiar with it, then that lends to the, you know, the support for that, for their belief or their understanding of what they in fact possessed.
Mr. Root, I think Judge Hooten asked the excellent question. Is that in the record in terms of the chemical effects of hemp versus the chemical effects of marijuana?
I do not believe that the sort of distinction between, you know, what happens when you smoke or ingest hemp versus smoking marijuana, I do not believe that that is in the record, no.
Is that something you believe we could take judicial notice of?
I expect if there's a reliable source or some other if there's a reliable source for that information, then I think that could be something that this court could take notice of. Yes.
Why did our legislature decide that one was a legal substance and the other was an illegal substance? According to at least the briefing, they look the same, and they both contain at least some concentration of THC.
Yeah, that's a good point, Your Honor. I think that it goes exactly to the reasoning, that concentration of THC is the important consideration that distinguishes an illegal controlled substance that will have some sort of altering effect on you versus a legal non-controlled substance that does not have that effect. So I think that's right. And I think that, while we don't, of course, have the concentration of the substance here, the knowledge of the difference between the two, the effect that it might have on the user is, you know, an important consideration when considering whether the facts in total do establish probable cause.
So, counsel, going to the concentration question, now the field test that is in the record here does not reveal concentration, right, of this particular substance.
Correct.
So you don't have that. Now, at time of trial, you know, say we were to go ahead and the state were allowed to put on its evidence and say it were to do so without further testing of the material in this case. So you're resting your entire case and the jury convicted the defendant on this evidence, would that judgment of conviction withstand a sufficiency challenge?
I think that might depend on what total facts were introduced at trial.
Assume the same facts you listed them just a second ago. So just go with those facts. You have nothing new, no further testing.
That could support a finding, I believe. I don't think it would be a rock solid case, but I think that it could support a finding under language such as this court's opinion, State v. Nock, where depending on the facts of a case, the state does not necessarily have to perform confirmatory testing on controlled substances. So under that language, this case could survive a sufficiency challenge. It would, I think, be difficult.
So are you referring to the, and I might have the name wrong, is it Oldhausen, where the drugs were destroyed by the defendant?
No, Your Honor.
A different case. Knox, was that it?
Knock. K-N-O-C-H. It's an opinion of this court from 2010, I believe. In Knock, there was charges of possession of methamphetamine. The defendants moved to dismiss for lack of probable cause, saying that the field test that indicated the substance was methamphetamine was not sufficient to establish probable cause. And this court held that the state can establish probable cause with only a field test, depending on the facts of the case.
So that's where any amount of methamphetamine is illegal, right? And we don't have a concentration issue, and it's an amount issue with meth.
That's right.
Isn't that an important distinction?
It is a distinction, but I think that the use of field tests versus confirmatory tests for all controlled substances is still relevant, because my understanding is that the practice in Hennepin County is generally, you know, a field test may be used initially, but that all controlled substances will be tested in a lab for purposes of trial. So that the field test is usually not what's relied on in order to actually prove guilt. So that you know, the field test indicates, yes, this does in fact appear to be a controlled substance, but then you take the additional step of confirming and establishing that it is in fact that controlled substance. I'd also like to just briefly touch on the fact that the district court's ruling here focuses on the testing and the concentration and sort of holds that is the most important factor and ignores other evidence that could be used to support finding probable cause, like the evidence that's in this case, like an admission, evidence such as the statement of a confidential informant, a observation of a drug sale, and other factors that could, in conjunction with a field test, help support finding a probable cause. And I see that my time is up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rood. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Merchant, and I represent the respondent, Morris Dixon. I want to make sure I cover at least 2 points in response to counsel's argument. So I'm going to highlight them immediately. First of all, there's an important distinction between the standard for probable cause for arrest and probable cause for charging and proceeding to trial. In Florence, the court, as I note in my brief, said that distinction is quote unquote significant. The standard which counsel for the state relies on from State v. Harris is the standard for probable cause for arrest. It's a search warrant case, but the court uses the probable cause for arrest standard, which I will quote, it says exists where the facts would lead a person of ordinary care and prudence to entertain an honest and strong suspicion that the person under consideration is guilty of a crime. The operative terms there are to entertain an honest and strong suspicion. That's the probable cause standard for arrest, not the higher standard of probable cause for detention. In response to your question, Judge Hooten, there are two different standards. You can call probable cause plus if you like, but the law is clear, and I would direct the court's attention specifically to the Supreme Court's discussion of the higher standard of probable cause in the Slaughter case cited in my brief. And in Slaughter, and again, I'm quoting, the test for granting a motion for a directed verdict is whether the evidence is sufficient to present a fact question for the jury's determination after viewing the evidence and all resulting inferences in favor of the state. That's the motion for judgment of acquittal standard in Rule 2603. Subdivision 18-1A. That is the proper probable cause standard for purposes of this case. Or in other words, also cited in Slaughter, the Supreme Court cited favorably to an Eighth Circuit case, which is quoted on pages 9 and 10 of my brief, in the United States versus Richard case, which again says, quote, a motion of acquittal should be granted only where the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the government is such that a reasonably minded jury must have a reasonable doubt as to the existence of any of the essential elements of the crime charge. The standard is a motion for judgment of acquittal. I know all three members of this panel were trial court judges. That's a legal question that comes up pursuant to a motion for judgment of acquittal. That is the standard that needs to be applied here. Now, with respect to the evidence, again, Judge Hooten, you asked about whether someone who smoked marijuana would know the effects and whether or not that would be sufficient evidence. I would commend to the court's attention the case of Vail, which held, except the trial court's findings at a bench trial, that the scientific evidence on the element of identity, which is at issue here because of the concentration level, in Vail, the scientific evidence was inadequate. Therefore, the state tried to argue the circumstantial evidence would support a finding of probable cause for purposes of charging. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that it was insufficient, including with respect to your question, Judge Hooten, about the use of marijuana and knowing it. I'd like to again quote from Vail. The Supreme Court said, "The inferred fact which the court makes that a seller of a product containing 220 pounds is probably sophisticated and competent and alert enough to have made his own tests before he himself bought the product for presumably a considerable sum of money from his supplier. Whether that task was simply smoking the product in order to test the substance or whether the product was otherwise analyzed is of course unknown to the court," close quote. But regardless, the circumstantial evidence there was 220 pounds of marijuana purchased in an undercover buy at a price of $120 a pound for what the seller or purchaser called quote unquote Mexican grade marijuana. The Supreme Court there said that those circumstances were insufficient for purposes of establishing identity. In Robinson, the Supreme Court said that it was expected to scientifically test the substance for purposes of the identity element. And the circumstantial evidence there with regards to the packaging, the way that it was being sold, was insufficient. And this court in Carpenter followed Robinson and rejected the state's position that even if the identity was not established by means of some sort of scientific testing, that the circumstantial evidence there proved identity.
Isn't this a matter, though? I mean, I'm glad you addressed my question first about probable cause. I appreciate you doing that. That what may be sufficient for probable cause for arrest may not be sufficient for whether a person should be required to proceed to trial under Florence. And are there other cases you could direct us to that basically make that distinction?
Well, as I said, Judge Hooten, I would direct the court's attention to the Slaughter case, which I just quoted from and which is cited in my brief. It's at 691 Northwest 2nd 70. And Slaughter incorporation or by reference, the Supreme Court in Slaughter referenced the United States versus Richard Eighth Circuit test for what constitutes probable cause for purposes of charging and proceeding to trial.
All right. Well, could I ask you this then? Because I mean, in either case, you would consider the totality of the circumstances, right? Making that assessment, either it's for an arrest or for determining probable cause for under Florence.
You would consider the totality of circumstances, Judge Hooten, but for purposes of the element in question here on the identification of the substance in Vail, the Supreme Court held that the state must prove the actual identity of the substance. So circumstantial evidence there, or totality of circumstances, if you will, I would submit under Vail, where I just quoted from, where they strictly held that the scientific, because the scientific evidence was not sufficient for purposes of proving actual identity, those circumstantial evidence was not sufficient. Then you couple that with Robinson.
Yeah, but you know, Vail was a that was a conviction reversed after a trial. I mean, it seems to me that's a little different here. And I guess I'd like to follow up on Judge Hooten's question, Mr. Rood. I mean, it goes to the slurred speech. If you can't get high on hemp, but you can get high on marijuana, and one indication, which I assume is true, so just assume that for the record, then doesn't the slurred speech bear some importance in this case as to whether he was smoking hemp or smoking marijuana, or had been smoking hemp or versus smoking marijuana?
Judge Conley, I don't think so for a couple of reasons. First of all, with regard to your earlier question about the record, there is no record evidence that discusses whether or not if one smokes hemp versus marijuana, there can be an intoxicating effect. And if you're going to take judicial notice of that, I would submit the court's going to find that there's plenty of evidence out there that hemp also can produce a high, and that there's an entire commercial enterprise and industry out there now that is using hemp products for what is in the industry often referred to as marijuana light or a light high. So I would take the position that you could not take judicial notice of that in case.
Well, could we take judicial notice of the fact that it's the level of concentration of THC that produces the high? I mean, it seems to me that's what the legislature was focusing on when they said hemp okay, marijuana but still bad. I mean, does the level of THC, is that what causes you to kind of get high?
I think, again, Judge Connolly, that is a slippery road, and without expert testimony and scientific evidence, I don't think that you can make such a broad, conclusive determination about that. But putting that aside, with regard to the slurred speech.
Well, then why, following up, I mean, then I'll just ask one. I mean, then why did the legislature make the call? I mean, clearly to them, it was the level of THC. That's why we're here. The whole point of whether he should be charged with this depends on whether there was more or less 0.3% THC in, whatever the stuff was that was in his car. So, I understand the points you're making, but at some point we do have to sort of, even at the appellate court, apply common sense.
I understand, Judge Connolly. And again, my point would be, if what you're suggesting common sense shows is that you can get high with a concentration level of THC above 0.3%, but not high under hemp below 0.3%, I don't think that the science or the actual application of the use of hemp in the commercial sphere would bear that out. And so because of that, and with respect to slurred speech, again, weighing that in the light most favorable to the state, I'm not saying that it is irrelevant, but what I am saying is that it does not show the actual identity of the substance. Just as you, I believe, asked, if it turned out to be oregano, even though the user believed psychosomatically or otherwise that somehow they were under the influence, it would not be chargeable. It would not survive a motion for judgment of acquittal at the trial stage, which is the appropriate standard for purposes of assessing probable cause in this case to proceed to trial. So
can I ask you this question? You know, I go back to, I think you pointed out we were all district court judges at one point. And one, how is this any different than a DWI charge without a chemical test? Because I know that was one of the reasons why test refusal was pushed in the legislature, because you basically went to trial without a test on a DWI, and you had to prove by circumstantial evidence that they were that the person was intoxicated. Isn't this really what we're talking about here, is whether there's direct or circumstantial evidence? And obviously the state's going to have an easier time with direct evidence than they are circumstantial evidence. And the state's going to have the heightened standard of review for any charges proved up by circumstantial evidence. Why would our analysis be different than here, than in the usual case where the state is allowed to proceed at the lower level of probable cause with the expectation that they're going to have their work cut out for, or the state's going to have a lot of work at trial proving this charge by circumstantial evidence rather than direct evidence?
I think the short answer, Judge Hooten, is again the standard of probable cause that we're applying here, which is for purposes of charging and proceeding to trial rather than arrest. And I'm not an expert in the DUI sphere, but my impression of the case law is that if you just have one factor such as slurred speech, that's not necessarily sufficient for purposes of probable cause to proceed forward. And I would analogize this case in the DUI context to almost being akin to like an intoxilizer situation, or some kind of instrument for measuring, where you might, putting aside the identity of the substance, because of the differential here for purposes of THC concentration levels, if you don't have any evidence that meets that threshold, just as if you wouldn't have that measurement in an intoxilizer administration, you couldn't proceed for a DUI conviction with regard to being over the 0.18 or whatever the threshold is there. And with respect to just general intoxication, as opposed to using the provision of the DUI statute that uses the measurement, I would submit that the slurring of the speech by itself, because really that's all that you have here.
You have more, because you have the very person that's being charged admitting or saying, I have marijuana. I possess marijuana. I'm using marijuana.
I see my time's up. Can I respond to that?
Please do, Mr. Merchant. Thank you. Please do.
Thank you. I would point out to the court again the Vail case, which says that any statement or admission with respect to a user's belief about what the substance is not sufficient evidence for purposes of establishing the actual identity of the substance. The Vail court said it's merely an assertion of belief, and I discussed that at length in my brief, so I would draw that to the court's attention along with the analysis of the circumstantial facts the state's relying on here. If there are no further questions, and again, I see I'm out of time, I thank the court for this time.
Thank you, Mr. Merchant. Mr. Rude, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, respondent relies on Vail and Robinson, and in his brief, respondent counsel for respondent also relied on Olhausen. And as Judge Connolly pointed out, Vail is a sufficiency case following conviction. And I will also note that Robinson and Olhausen are also sufficiency cases following convictions for possession of controlled substance, which is a different higher standard to meet than the probable cause standard, because of course the state, in order to get to the point of a conviction, has to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So I think that—
So counsel, you reject the argument that Mr. Merchant is making based on the Slaughter case, that there is this higher probable cause standard applicable, which I think you agree that it's applicable to the motion for judgment of acquittal, but you would disagree that it applies to a motion to dismiss a complaint at this stage.
Yes, I would, Your Honor.
Okay, I just want to make sure I have it's tracking you, but thank you.
Yes, and just to make my point a little more clearly, I just wanted to argue that Vail, Robinson, and Olhausen are not as useful in this case where we have not reached the stage of a trial and a conviction. So I would point the court instead to Knock. Again, that's K-N-O-C-H. I believe I cite that in my brief. That is at the probable cause stage in that case, and I think is more pertinent to this court's review.
So you disagree that there's a different, that probable cause is probable cause, and it doesn't matter whether it's at the time of arrest or at the time of the omnibus hearing? Is that what you're arguing here?
I think that respondents' argument in favor of this sort of higher probable cause, or the connection to the motion for acquittal, is not a useful understanding of this. So yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor. And on the subject of Knock, I did want to bring up another one of my arguments, that in this case, the district court held that the state must fully test marijuana prior to this charging stage. And this creates a bright line rule, a bright line test for probable cause, which this court in Knock rejected. This court said that there is no bright line requirement for probable cause. It's a case by case, a fact specific determination. So I think that the district court's ruling is erroneous in that sense, because it requires a very specific sort of a bright line factor that is not appropriate under a probable cause determination.
Well, but how do you, and I agree with you, I have Knock in front of me, that's what it says, but how do you respond to Mr. Merchant's arguments and the arguments made below that, well, you know, the legislature has made the call that hemp is okay, but marijuana is still bad. And so, I mean, I assume the concern is that a lot of people are going to be arrested for possessing hemp, which is legal. And why should they have to wait until trial for the BCA to test, you know, the stuff to determine whether it's hemp or marijuana? I mean, how do you respond to that? Because, I mean, I get that. And I find that, you know, somewhat, I find that to have merit.
There are two responses to that, Your Honor. First is that the use of the other facts and circumstances in the case, you know, whether any effects such as slurred speech or bloodshot eyes or something like that, admissions from the defendant, these other sorts of facts can help distinguish for the police and the state at the evidence phase or the investigation phase and the charging stage, whether this person has possessed hemp or marijuana. And also note that, you know, in this case, respondent agreed, waived his rights and agreed to speak with police and admitted affirmatively that he possessed marijuana. He did not tell police, no, this is hemp or something like that. So, and as respondent noted in his brief, I believe possession of hemp is an affirmative defense to a possession of marijuana charge. So that is an avenue for someone who is arrested or who is found to be in possession of hemp. That's something that they can say right away. No, this is hemp. I have a receipt or something like that. Or just, you know, this is actually hemp. It's not marijuana. That's an option that that they have at the outset to avoid those sorts of issues and sort of a mistaken identity situation. And I see that my time is up. So if there are no further questions, I would just ask that the district court's decision be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Merchant. Thank you, Mr. Rood. The matter was well briefed and well argued. We will issue our decision in 90 days. Mr. Rood, please give my warmest regards to my former clerk, Stephen Grego, and Mr. Merchant, please give my warmest regards to my former clerk, Abby Rankin, in your office. So thank you very much. The matter is submitted.